Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Thursday, the 11th of May. This evening at 9 p.m., the Discovery Channel, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Check your local listings for the time near you. Here on the Pacific Coast, actually, it's also 9 p.m., so like I said, check out your local cable company. Discovery Channel will be doing a one-hour special, JFK Assassination Files, or Conspiracy Files, JFK Assassination, I think is the title of it. And my co-author, Lamar Waldron, and I will be featured. Our book, Ultimate Sacrifice, and some of the issues that we talk about in that. So just give you a heads up on that. If you're up and around 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock on the East Coast, I'll actually be on the air on the Majority Report. I'll be filling in for Janine Garofalo and Sam Cedar tonight on Air America Radio and tomorrow night. And by 9 o'clock here, I'll be back home. And so looking forward to it. Time now for our update, our Iraq update. Yes, Republicans?
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Kicking off. Kicking off. Kicking off. Kicking off. Karl Rove, he didn't serve. Dick Cheney. He didn't serve. Tom DeLay. He didn't serve. And George Bush was AWOL. Chickenhawks.
And with chickenhawks in the background, we find in Baghdad, four street cleaners were killed and another wounded when a roadside bomb went off in the Mansour district in west central Baghdad overnight. Iraqi police in Baqaba, an army arrested 25 gunmen wearing army uniforms near the religiously mixed city of Baqaba, near, but this is about 65 kilometers, 40 miles north of Baghdad. In Baghdad, gunmen shot dead a judicial investigator near a courthouse in central Baghdad. In Basra, gunmen killed Khalid al-Sadoun, a member of the Iraqi Islamic Party, a major Sunni party, along with two aides on Wednesday in the small town of al-Zubir near Basra, 550 kilometers south of Baghdad, an official of the Islamic Party and the head of the city council in Basra said. And also in Baqaba, gunmen killed a woman school teacher and wounded her 14-year-old nephew, police said. Yes, we can't allow women to teach school in Iraq, after all, can we? By the way, did you note that the State Department has come out with a new list of terrorist organizations, and the Taliban is not on the list? This is pretty bizarre. The State Department's list of terrorist organizations does not include the Taliban, the terrorist organization that we said we invaded Afghanistan to overthrow. Now, why would they not include the Taliban? Could be because the Taliban now controls more of Afghanistan than we do. And they don't really want to say the terrorists are winning. So now it's just, well, it's the Taliban winning. After all, George W. Bush in March of 2001 gave the Taliban $54 million, wrote them a check in exchange for their not growing opium. Say, hey, you guys don't grow opium, we'll give you some money. Now they're growing opium again. By the way, coming up on today's program in the second hour of our show, Lester Brown is going to be dropping by about his new book, Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Our question for the day, are we seeing the work of the Founding Fathers destroyed by George W. Bush? Our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy, our problems are man-made, therefore they may be solved by man. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. An optimistic outlook and hopefully an accurate one. I think so. You know, I think that we have a lot of potential here, an awful lot of potential in this country and in this world. I have to say, you know, I remember back years ago, probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, Dan Quinn, the guy who wrote Ishmael and My Ishmael and The Story of Bee and a number of books. I've written blurbs for several of them. You'll find, you know, my name on the back of at least one of his books. and who's Dan Quinn's been on our program. Great guy and a brilliant commentator. If you haven't read the Ishmael books, you must. And he used to, his website used to, the opening page, this was like 5, 6, 8 years ago, back when Julian Simon was still alive, his website said, do you want to save the world, yes or no? And if you clicked yes, you went into the Dan Quinn website. If you clicked no, it took you to Julian Simon's website. Julian Simon was a professor at Columbia University. And Julian Simon, on the one hand, was notorious for being used by right-wing causes to suggest that, you know, there is no problem, there's no crisis, there's no population crisis, quack, 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 that kind of thing. And, in fact, he had a bet with Paul Ehrlich back in the 70s when the population bomb came out, Paul Ehrlich, the author of that book, in which he said, you know, the price of commodities is not going to go up the way Paul Ehrlich said it would, because Paul Ehrlich predicted that within, I believe it was a 10-year period, as I recall, might have been even shorter than that, might have been 5 years, within a certain number of years, Paul Ehrlich said that the price of zinc, the price of copper, the price of oil, all these things were going to double in price. And Julian Simon said, no, they won't. And they won't because of human ingenuity. We'll figure out new ways to get more of it, or we'll find out ways to recycle it, or we'll find out ways to use less of it in manufacture, those kinds of things. And because of human ingenuity, the price won't go up. And Paul Ehrlich actually lost that bet. And Julian Simon, and you know, a lot of folks to this day say, see, Paul Ehrlich was wrong. Well, the reality is Paul Ehrlich was right in his book, The Population Bomb. The mass famines that he was describing and the massive overpopulation and the environmental degradation has actually happened. It just hasn't so much happened here in the United States, although we're beginning to see the cracks show here as well. But it certainly has happened in the rest of the world. And you know, in the 24 hours since this time yesterday, 54,000 people have died of starvation, for example, 38,000 of them children. So, but the point that I'm making is that Julian Simon actually had this belief, which I share, that there, not that there's necessarily, to quote John Kennedy, that there's no problem humans can't solve that humans have created, because I think it is quite conceivable that we can create problems that we can't solve. But that broadly speaking, the greatest natural resource in the world is not oil, it's not copper, it's not zinc, it's not gold, it's not land, it's not trees. The greatest resource, at least in terms of humans and human society and our ability to interact with the planet, is our intellect. And I would actually go beyond that. I would go beyond Simon. I would say it's not just our intellect. I would say it's our emotional and our spiritual mind. I don't have a word for it. Our you can say your intellectual mind. You can't say your spiritual mind. But the confluence of our intellect, our emotion, and our spirituality, our ability to stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon and go, wow. I mean, even if you don't believe in, quote, God, end quote, that's spirituality in my mind. To look up at the stars at night and just have your breath taken. Just, holy cow, this is so much bigger than me. That fundamental, you know, to look into nature and see all the life around you and go, yeah, I'm part of that. That spirituality, the emotionality, the this is my family, these are my community, we're all human beings, this person is just like me, or even different from me in these regards, and I can still respect them as a human being. These animals have as much of a right to life as I do here. This world is a living thing. Just that's the emotional connection to everything. And of course the intellectual capability that we have, which we can't diminish. And where we run into problems, in my opinion, and I didn't mean to turn this into a whole screed about this, so I'll wrap this up, but where we're running into the problem, in my opinion, is when any one of those three becomes absolutely wildly lopsided, when we don't temper our spirituality with practicality. You know, it's the old saying, you have your head in the heavens and your feet on the ground. When we don't temper our practicality, our intellect, with spirituality and emotionality, when we don't temper our emotions with our intellect and our spirituality, I think that we have to strive for a balance of these three. And there's probably other dimensions to it that I'm missing, but in my mind, these are the primary ones. So, in any case, back to the question of, you know, what's up with the Bush administration undoing the work of the founders of this country? Now we have the former NSA director, and this ties into my theme that, you know, we can solve these problems. And in fact, as bad as it seems, we are solving these problems. Here's the former director of the National Security Agency, and a former admiral, by the way, in the United States Navy, Bobby Ray Inman. He was the head of the NSA under Jimmy Carter, and he has now come out and said, of this so-called terrorist surveillance program. What it really is George Bush and Michael Hayden illegally wiretapping Americans and saying, we don't need no stinking warrant because I'm the president and we're in a war. Well, I'm sorry, the war was declared over. I recall it rather clearly. I think the rest of us do. George W. Bush coming out and saying,
my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
So, to the best of my knowledge, we're not in a war, number one. And number two, this is just plain old flat out illegal. It's unconstitutional and it's illegal. So we'll get back to this. I've got some audio for you and, of course, your calls. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Take a deep breath. Feel like you're choking. Maybe you're broken.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Gotta check out something amazing. Look at votecorporate.org. There's a group here in Oregon that is running a corporation for governor. Seriously, they're running a corporation for governor. Their slogan is, it's called Rich Corporate Son Incorporated. They created a corporation called Rich Corporate Son, Inc. They're running him for governor. And their slogan, because we run the government anyway. Campaign manager, guy by the name of Hal Burton. And you can check it out at votecorporate.org. Anyhow, back to the NSA. The Justice Department, the Bush Justice Department, the Alberto Gonzalez Bush Justice Department, the Alberto Gonzalez Death Squad John Negroponte George W. Bush Justice Department is supposed to be investigating the George W. Bush John Negroponte Michael Hayden NSA on this illegal spying program. The illegal terrorist surveillance program that Bush, the so-called that Bush calls. Our question, of course, are we seeing the work of the founding fathers destroyed by George W. Bush? And as Devlin Barrett in the Associated Press notes, the government has abruptly ended an inquiry into the warrantless eavesdropping program because the National Security Agency refused to grant Justice Department lawyers the necessary security clearance to probe the matter. In other words, you can't look into our illegal spying on you because we're not going to give you a security clearance that would give you access to tell you, to what we're doing. The Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility sent a fax to Representative Maurice Hinchey, Democrat from New York, on Wednesday saying that they were closing their inquiry. They're closing it. Because without clearance, their lawyers cannot examine Justice Department lawyers' role in the program. Hinchey said lawmakers would push to find out who at the NSA denied the Justice Department lawyers' security clearance. He says this administration thinks they can just violate any law they want, and they've created a culture of fear to try and get away with that. It's up to us to stand up to them, is what Hinchey said. And good on him for saying that. I mean, there's not enough. Not enough people out there saying, speaking up right now and saying, no, we that's it. We are going to stand up to this thing. This is just absolutely over the top. And you have the Democrats all afraid that if they pick a fight with the Republicans, that is somehow going to cause the Republicans to go up in their approval ratings. And you got the Republicans on the other hand saying, we want to fight. Let's shove 20 judges into the pipeline so we can get a fight because the American people love it when there's a fight. And the Democrats are going, oh, no, we don't want to have a fight. As Russ Feingold pointed out in talking about his opposition to the NSA, to Michael Hayden as head of the NSA.
The consultants and the pundits and others will tell you positions are, quote, losers. I've heard that literal language for this. And that it is dangerous to let there be any real light between our position and the White House's position, or else you'll get called soft on terrorism. You're already here. People saying that this Michael Hayden nomination will be a great opportunity for the White House to show that Democrats are soft on terrorism. Now, you bet the pundits in this town will somehow suggest that this, too, just like my censure resolution, will cause the president's numbers to shoot up. You remember that happening, right? It didn't happen at all. But that's what they're going to say. And it's not right.
Then it's not right. But that is what they're going to say, and that's, you know, that's what they're saying. You tune into the pundits and, Democrats, they better be careful. They pick on Bush too much. His numbers will go up, you know. And the Democrats are all going, oh, yeah, they're right. We can't pick on Bush. Oh, no. It's truly mind-boggling. Truly mind-boggling. In the midst of this, we have George W. Bush taking apart a constitutional government. Here's Jonathan Turley. Jonathan Turley is, this guy's no slouch. Right, he's a professor at he teaches at the George Washington University Law School. He holds the Shapiro Chair for Public Interest Law. Before that, he was one of the youngest professors to be offered tenure at Tulane University Law School. This guy he's a lawyer's lawyer. He's the teacher of a lawyer's lawyer. Here are his comments yesterday on Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
This president's theory of his power is now, I think, so extreme that it's unprecedented. He believes that he has the inherent authority to violate federal law. He has said that, not just in signing statements, in the infamous torture memo that Alberto Gonzalez signed. It was stated that he could, in some circumstances, order federal officials to violate federal law. And this is consistent across the board with this president. Frankly, I'm not too sure what he thought he was swearing to when he took the oath of office to uphold the Constitution and our laws. I've never seen a president who's so uncomfortable in his constitutional skin.
All of this, Jonathan, has been likened to the swing of a pendulum, that this is Vice President Cheney, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, hearkening back to their days as rookies.
Yeah, well, and pardon me, Keith Olbermann in there and shouldn't have been in the end of that clip. In any case, that Jonathan Turley on the Keith Olbermann program, and the oath that the president took says something really quite different. In fact, it's specified in the Constitution of the United States that he will uphold the Constitution of America, not his own power, not the executive branch, not the Bush family, not the Carlyle Group, the Constitution of the United States. Read the Fourth Amendment, my friends. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We can see what you're up to, George, and it doesn't look good. Welcome back, my friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on AirAmericaRadio.com, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, etc., and syndicated by Air America Radio. There's an extraordinary PSA running on radio stations around the country that I'd like to share with you and then bring on the fellow who helped put it together. Here it is. Listen to this.
This is Ed Asner. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635 for an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
And my friends at AfterDowningStreet.org, David Swanson and Ed all put that thing together, and Ed Asner started, and Ed Asner on the line with us. Ed, welcome.
Thank you. Cindy just left, but she said to send you a big hello.
Well, thank you, and give my very best to her, too.
She thinks the world of you.
Well, and I do of her, too, and of you. In fact, when I first started this radio program a little over 3 years ago, on a radio station in Burlington, Vermont, which we're still on right now. Well, only now they're carrying it as part of Air America's programming, WVAA in Burlington. We started on the weekends there. You were a guest on one of my very first programs when it was just a local show, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, I'm delighted what sprang from it.
Yes, and you helped it. Lou Grant, of course, probably one of your more, at least one of the roles that I remember you the best for. I know you've done so many things in your career over the years. Ed Asner, the challenge or the campaign of your life right now is a political one. It seems that most of your focus is on political activities.
Well, that's to fill in when I don't have a day job. I busy myself wherever I can, be it the questioning on 9/11, or be it some means of fighting this administration, or some means of trying to entertain and abet anybody who can provide some greater measure of peace in the Middle East.
Yeah, it seems like these are the really critical issues of our time that we just really must engage ourselves in. The ad calling for the impeachment or an investigation that might lead to the impeachment of George W. Bush. What kind of feedback are you getting on this? How do you think this is playing out? I mean, the conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C., and particularly among the Democratic strategists, is, oh, don't do that. When the Republicans impeached Clinton, it didn't help them.
Seems like
nonsense to me. But what kind of feedback are you getting?
You know, it's amazing. If I didn't have some very good friends who were Democrats and great politicians, I would say, please don't utter that blasphemous word Democrat to me, because I don't like to be associated with the idea. I have had no feedback at all. I would like to know what kind of feedback Conyers has gotten. And he's a great man.
He is.
Democrat.
He's regularly on our program, and he's hearing it from everybody. I mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi essentially disavowed him, a week or two ago on Face the Nation?
Oh, did she really?
Yeah, I believe it was, I'm forgetting his name now, but the guy who does Face the Nation, he said, John Conyers says, here's his website, and he says he's going to launch an investigation into George W. Bush if the Democrats take control of the House. And Nancy Pelosi said, well, he's not the one who makes those decisions, or words to that effect. But then she did, to her credit, go on to say, we will investigate what George W. Bush has been up to. So
yeah.
I guess in a way she backed off and then she pushed forward.
Uh-huh.
Which is kind of the Democratic way these days.
Talking out of both sides of the mouth.
Yeah, tragically.
Yeah.
So what should Democrats...
Oh, by the way.
Yes, sir.
One little thing I did. I just came back from a cruise in the Mediterranean. But before I did, I left out of Fort Lauderdale, and I got a request from L.A. to go down there and help the University of Miami strikers, the janitors.
Oh, yeah.
So I stopped by there, and I made a little stiff talk to a few janitors and lovely people down there. The volunteers were even lovelier than the janitors. I mean, priests and teachers,
yeah,
putting their asses on the line, and students. It was glorious to see, and I just got a letter that the strike was won. So I'm delighted to claim that.
Yeah, we've been following that on this program, SEIU Local 11, SEIU11.org, in fact, their website. And that's great that you were down there and pitching in. What, in your mind, how best can this play out? There are those who say, let's focus entirely on getting a Democratic majority elected so that they will have the subpoena power so that they can investigate Bush. There are others who say, no, we should really be pushing the idea of impeaching Bush because that will energize the Democratic base and get them out there that will produce that Democratic majority. And then there are those who say, of course, as we've heard, no, don't do that because that will energize the Republican base. And in fact, the Republicans are using this. I get these emails from the RNC almost every day, the ones that go out to all the talk show hosts all around the country, mostly to right-wing talk show hosts, talking about how impeachment is at the top of the Democratic agenda, therefore we have to get Republicans out to vote.
Yeah.
How should this be fought?
I am no political maven. I'm a bloodthirsty sucker, and I would just soon see how many people can be enlisted to pursue the impeachment angle and to accrue more and more evidence as we go along, so that by the time we get into 2007, with some of the verdicts being handed down, maybe sufficient numbers of people will then fall into the program.
Yeah, and in the meantime, Bush seems to be hell-bent for leather on stacking the court. He had 20 judicial nominees yesterday, including the First Circuit in Washington, D.C., where Karl Rove would have his appeals heard. What a surprise.
As I read recently, that's their only hope of gaining some positive PR, okay, is by showing how obstinate and adamant and resistant the Democrats are to putting judges in there. And yet they have, if the Democrats just came forward and said, shut up, we have admitted this many judges in this administration, which I believe is beyond the norm for most administrations.
Yeah, this is what the Republicans did to Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
I mean, his full last year, they didn't let any judges through, or very, very few. And so there were all these empty judgeships, or whatever they call them, judge seats, when George W. Bush came into office. And so he could just roll these folks in.
I think that as brilliant as Bill is, that he laid the groundwork for a lot of what happened to us.
Yeah, well, a lot of it was the DLC, the whole DLC thing of, you know, the unions have been killed off by Ronald Reagan's declaration of war, and where are we going to get the money? Well, gee, the corporations have some money. Let's go to the so-called middle. It's a tragedy. We have to take back America. Well, Ed Asner, I want to thank you so much for the work that you're doing to help us take back America. It's so important.
Well, man, the pleasure's all mine, believe
me. You are one of our most articulate spokesmen and one of my heroes, and thank you so much for being on our program as well today.
I want to thank you for having me, and I'm glad I was there at the birthing.
Yeah, and you were. Thank you. Okay, good talk.
Good luck, Tom.
Thank you very much. Ed Asner with us here on the program today, and just a great, a truly great America. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And let's see here, Gary in Little Rock, Arkansas on the line. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Tom, right before your program began, I heard on AP News where after 9/11, all the telephone companies have been recording the phone numbers that called and who they called.
Yeah, it's not all the phone companies. Quest has refused to participate in this, but the big three, yes.
You know, that when I first heard that, I thought, oh, so what? You know, they're just taking care of the phone numbers. But what happens then is that becomes a situation of guilt by association. Either if I break some law or whatever, then everybody that I have come in contact with becomes linked with me, or vice versa. If somebody calls me or other people that does something, you know, that is a really scary road to go down.
Well, for example, Gary, let's just imagine that sometime in the last 2 or 3 years, somebody who really is a bad guy, some terrorist affiliated somebody, or somebody who's a relative of a real terrorist, or who lives in the apartment and has the phone number that used to be occupied by a real terrorist, happened to call this program to say something. You've now called this program. So now the phone company says, Gary in Little Rock, he's somehow associated with this terrorist. Check him out.
It's
bizarre.
It's a way of putting down dissent by virtue of fear, making certain that we're afraid that who we talk to, it's just extending this concept of fear to even who we talk to or who might call us.
Yeah,
it is really more scary than what, you know, at first, like I say, I thought, so what? But I'll tell you what, I think the ramifications are more than we intend, you know, can imagine.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see how Bush spins this thing. The story from USA Today, the National Security Agency has been secretly collecting the phone calls of tens of millions of Americans. Gary, thanks for the call. Using data provided by AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South. The NSA program reaches into homes and businesses across the nation. This is a front page headline, by the way, in the USA Today today. By amassing information about the calls of ordinary Americans, most of whom are not suspected of crimes. Bush is out there backpedaling as fast as he can away from this. I'll tell you about it right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
No, we've got no gasoline. Come here, I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you, I'm higher in the food chain.
Him back in. Me. Welcome back, my friends. Every now and then, you know, it's Lee Raymond just pops up. Anyhow, is George Bush dismantling American democracy? It's sure looking like it. I'm telling you, when you have lost the guy who came up with the single bullet theory, you know, I've talked before about you. When you've lost Merle Haggard, you've lost America. When you've lost the guy who came up with the single bullet theory, you've lost the Republicans. Arlen Specter was a lawyer for the House for the Warren Commission, and he came up with the idea. This is before he was an elected politician. He came up with the idea that this bullet, you know, went through John Kennedy, paused in midair for 1.3 seconds, made a left turn, paused for 0.6 seconds, went through his knee, paused for a 0.1 second, went through John Connell, you know, the whole thing. And I'm sure all of my seconds and percentages of seconds are wrong, but you know what I'm talking about. This is the magic bullet theory. That was Arlen Specter's idea. And Arlen Specter now is saying, as senator from Pennsylvania, is now saying he's going to call the phone companies to appear before his Senate Judiciary Committee that he's the chairman of to, quote, find out exactly what's going on. Now, before this report came out in USA Today today, that would be like yesterday when Arlen Specter didn't know squat about this. No, seriously, he didn't know about this. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he was complaining that his committee has, quote, been unable to perform our constitutional oversight responsibilities to determine the constitutionality of the program, end quote, the program being Bush's warrantless, illegal, warrantless spying on Americans program. And now we discover that the warrantless spying on Americans doesn't just extend to listening to our phone calls, it extends to compiling with great detail, everybody that we're calling and connecting all the dots. So you may have thought that it was just Aunt Tilly that you were talking to last week when she was in the Denver airport passing through, but the guy who used that payphone just before she did happens to be on the terrorist watch list. And now the NSA is looking after you. Welcome to America. We now spell it with a K, not a C. Jim in Crossville, Tennessee. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
Just tuned into your show. Time listener, I'm enjoying it.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to kind of broach the impeachment of Bush. Some of my more conservative friends make the argument that Clinton's lying was an impeachable offense because he lied under oath. Bush's on lying about the war is not because he's not under oath. Well, my contention is that when took the under oath, swore to uphold the Constitution, he's lying about that because he sure as hell is not upholding it.
Yeah, no, it's you're absolutely right. It's very straightforward. In fact, Article 2 of the Constitution talks about the presidency. Section 1 of Article 2 is, you know, lays out what this guy, who he can be, you know, he has to be a citizen, he has to be 35 years of age, all this kind of stuff. The 8th paragraph says, before he enters in the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath. Right? This is an oath. He is under oath. Before he shall enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. End of quote. End full stop. End of sentence. End of paragraph. End of section. And so the only thing that the President, when he takes an oath of office, swears that he will do, is defend the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution very clearly says that nobody is to be snooping through our personal stuff, you know, the so-called Privacy Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and specifically or particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. So I would submit to you, Jim, that you're absolutely right. Bush has lied under oath. He has violated his oath of office, and that's a far more important oath than the oath that Bill Clinton took to tell the truth about whether or not he had sex with that woman. absolutely spot on. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along here. Ron in Seattle. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hi there.
Hey, Ron.
Yes, it's nice to talk to you. I listen to your show a lot in the car, but I'm home today, so I thought I'd try to get a hold of you. Well, anyway, what I'm calling about is the integrity of the voting process.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to watch Nancy Pelosi on Meet the Press on Sunday, and she's acting very, I'd say, cocky that the Democrats are going to take back the Senate and the House. But my gut feel is that we're not there yet with the integrity of this voting.
No, I keep remembering what happened in Georgia in 2002. In Georgia in 2002, the polls showed that Max Cleland was beating Saxby Chambliss by about 5 points. This was the polls taken 2 and 3 days before the election. The after-election polls, taken a couple of days after the election, showed that Max Cleland beat Saxby Chambliss by somewhere around 4 or 5 points. Saxby Chambliss, however, according to the electronic voting machines in the state of Georgia, none of which had a paper trail, and a whole bunch of them that the memory cards got lost, over 50 of them got lost on Election Day. The electronic voting machine said that Saxby Chambliss beat Max Cleland by about 5 points. And so the pundits were all at Twitter, gee, how do we explain this? And the explanation they all came up with was that somehow Saxby Chambliss, the guy who had a deferment from Vietnam, got out of service. The draft dodger was more acceptable to the military than Max Cleland, who lost 3 limbs in Vietnam and had been on the Senate Armed Services Committee for most of his career, a good friend of the Pentagon. And it's nonsense. Max Cleland won that election. There's no doubt in my mind. It was stolen. Now, whether it was stolen by a voting machine company or whether the machine company simply put into place, you know, lousy products that were easily hacked by Republicans, who knows? But I agree with you. We have a lot of work to do. Next, Planet Under Stress. Lester Brown will be with us. I'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Plan B 2.0. Rescuing a planet under stress and a civilization in trouble. Plan A, Lester Brown notes in the preface to his new book, Plan A was business as usual, and it has the world on an environmental path leading toward economic decline and eventual collapse. Plan B? Lester Brown, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Earthpolicy.org, the website, the book, Plan B 2.0 by Lester R. Brown. And, Lester, you, in your book, first of all, you start out entering a new world. You talk about the nature of the new world, learning from China, learning from the past, the emerging politics of scarcity. Give us a snapshot of that.
Well, probably the most powerful piece of analysis in the book is the one that looks at consumption in China, pointing out that China has now overtaken the U.S. in the consumption of most basic resources. The one in which we still lead is oil, but in grain consumption, meat consumption, coal use, steel, China's now way ahead of us on every one of those. Then the question becomes, what happens if they catch up to us in consumption per person? And that would happen around 2031 if they keep growing at 8% a year. By then, their incomes would be about the same as ours today. Then they would really be consuming resources. And when you run through those numbers, it's clear that the Western economic model, the fossil fuel-based, automobile-centered, throwaway economy, is not going to work for China.
In other words, there's not enough resources on the planet to sustain the average Chinese living the lifestyle of the average American.
That's right. And if it doesn't work for China, obviously it's not going to work for India, which by 2031 will have an even larger population. And interestingly, in an increasingly integrated global economy where we all depend on the same oil, grain, and steel, it won't work for us either. And that's probably the most powerful single finding in the book, and it sets the stage then for looking at the new economy, which will be powered by renewable sources of energy, which will have a much more diversified transport system. And instead of throwaway economy, it'll be a comprehensive reuse recycle economy.
Well, and in fact, let's just go through some of these things. We start out with the civilization in trouble in your book. We're talking with Lester Brown, earthpolicy.org, the new book, Plan B 2.0. Beyond the oil peak, L. King Hubbard, or M. King Hubbard, I forget, anyway, King Hubbard, the oil scientist, back in the 1950s, predicted that in the 1970s, America would hit a peak. Half of our oil would be gone, and then it would start getting scarcer and harder to suck out of the ground. You have to suck harder on the straw as the glass gets less full, and that the price would start going up. We'd have to start importing oil, and that happened in the 70s. And that there's a pretty broad consensus among oil scientists that we're at or near a worldwide Hubbard peak right now.
That's the that's probably the most alarming sort of things that's emerging with the focus now on oil reserves and production as a result of the rise in prices of the last couple of years. But you're right, most of the world's more eminent geologists now think that peak oil could come at any time, could be this year, next year, 5 years from now. But we're not prepared for a decline in oil production. The world in which you and I have spent our lifetimes has been one where oil production has been rising throughout that period. And the idea of living in a world where oil production is declining and where we're still adding 70 million people a year means that the oil supply per person will be in an almost free fall. And I just don't think we're at all prepared for that.
Yeah, and in fact, it's interesting, the Cato Institute this morning came out with a study. And we know they're biased, you know, this is a libertarian
right.
think tank, came out with a study suggesting that oil, that gasoline, which was at around 29 cents a gallon in 1955, if you take 29 cents in 1955 dollars and simply do the inflation conversion, that's $5.15 today.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're suggesting that for us to be buying gas at the same price that we were paying in 1955, we should be paying $5.15 a gallon. If that's true, and I have no reason to doubt it, even though it came out of the Cato Institute, that means that as we move into peak oil, we could, in very short order, be seeing $10, $15, $20 a gallon gasoline. Is that not possible?
It's entirely possible. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is that countries in Europe, like France, UK, Germany, today are paying between $5 and $7 a gallon. That's largely because they have a tax of $3 or $4 a gallon. And what I've recently proposed is that in this country, what we need to do is to lower income taxes and offset that with a rise in the gas tax. And I suggest doing it over a 10-year period, adding 30 cents a year to the tax on gasoline, so that 10 years from now we would have a $3 a gallon tax on gasoline. Get the price up to the point where it would actively encourage us to move toward a much more oil efficient, gasoline efficient economy. Without that, we're gonna fall flat on our faces when world oil production turns down if we're just not preparing for it.
Or when the Chinese consumption reaches the point where world oil production isn't enough for both of us.
Right.
And they got there first.
Right.
Or they're willing to pay more than we are. Shouldn't that tax be a percentage rather than a fixed amount, particularly given the possibility that the Bushies or whoever follows them, just to deal with this economic disaster the Bushies have created, have to inflate or continue to inflate our currency and deflate its value?
The principal concern I have with the very simple sort of tax shifting schedule that I outlined is that we need to make sure it doesn't hit low-income consumers too hard.
No, I'm agreeing with you on that.
Yeah.
I'm just suggesting that we have a gas tax. I think the federal gas tax right now is 18 cents a gallon, isn't it?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if that was set back, what, in the 1950s?
It goes way back. I mean,
And at that point, it was about 35-40% of the cost of a gallon of gas.
Right.
If instead of being 18 cents a gallon, it had been 30% of a gallon of gas,
right
now, the gas tax would be what, about a buck and a half, something like that, or a dollar a gallon.
Yeah.
And so as long as the government continues to deflate or to inflate our currency, to deflate the value of the dollar, which they have, you know, consistently been doing, and I don't see it stopping any day in the future. Seems like we should be looking at a percentage rather than a fixed number. But that's kind of minutia. We're picking at nits here. The emerging water shortages you talk about. Take a shot at that one.
Spreading water shortages are the real sleeper in the world economy. As world population has more than doubled over the last half century, world water use has tripled. As a result, in countries that contain half the world's people, water tables are now falling and wells are starting to go dry. And that includes each of the big three grain producers, that is China, India, and the United States, three countries that together account for roughly half of the world grain harvest. It's a much more serious problem in China and India than it is here, but even here in the southern Great Plains and the Southwest, tightening water shortages are leading cities to buy more and more irrigation water from farmers.
We only have a few seconds left, Lester Brown. Are you suggesting that we're going to run out of water before we run out of oil?
It's an interesting question. I was at the World Economic Forum in Davos, and the moderator introducing a session on water said that in some ways water is almost as important as oil. And I said, in some ways, water is more important than oil. We live for millions of years without oil. We would live for only days without water.
Yeah, and right now, actually, bottled water is more expensive than oil. So it's interesting. Lester Brown, the new book, Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble, the website earthpolicy.org. Lester Brown, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Incidentally, the book's available for free of charge at the website for downloading.
Oh, that's great, at earthpolicy.org.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for letting us know that. 15 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Hey, Tom. Well, Washington is abuzz, and it was too early, in fact, this morning for talking points, so early that at a press conference I attended at 10 with Senators Collins and Lieberman, respectively, of Maine and Connecticut. This was a press conference on FEMA, when the question was actually asked about the NSA's records of our phone calls, which they've been collecting in the tens of millions, neither one really had anything to say. In fact, to actually say that they melted away from the podium and disappeared through the doors sounds like an exaggeration, but they actually did.
Yeah, well, it's USA Today, of all things, broke this story, a big front-page story here today, and this could be the thing that, we'll see. My sense of it is that this could be the thing that really brings down the whole Bush intrusive, when we say wiretap, we're going to get a warrant and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Bush, in fact, here's his quote. You know,
now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way.
Yeah, see, nothing has changed.
Well, they're not wiretapping, Tom, because they're not listening to your call. They're just finding out who you called.
You know that, and I know that, but I'm guessing that probably a good half, maybe three-quarters of the people who just are sort of half paying attention to what's going on, they're going to conflate the two. They're going to say, what? Bush has my phone records?
And I think that there's the other piece is that an awful lot of people will then go, yep, there's a war on terror. Maybe they need it. Maybe it's okay.
I don't think so. This Bush was able, the fact that they're already backing away from this is something that tells me that this is, here it is. This is from the Associated Press this morning. Facing intense criticism from Congress, President Bush did not confirm the work of the National Security Agency, but sought to assure Americans that their privacy is being, quote, fiercely protected.
Right.
He says, we are not mining or trolling through the personal lives of innocent Americans. I'm telling you, you look back at Nixon, when presidents start denying things,
denying things that they're not acknowledging. I mean, which they don't need to acknowledge. It's in a tabloid newspaper. It wasn't in the Washington Post. USA Today is widely read. I mean, and it's read by an awful lot of people who don't read the Washington Post. He should be concerned about this. He should be very concerned. There is a rumor around Washington, but these things happen all the time, that this is damaging to Michael Hayden in his quest to become new director of the CIA.
I would think so.
I mean, it sounds like a duh, but he was kind of being viewed as a slam dunk, even though there was going to be tough questioning. He's not being viewed that way now.
Yeah, this is going to be the thing that's going to wake up the sleeping giant, I'm predicting. I may be wrong, but I don't think so. I think this is the point at which, because see with the terrorist surveillance program, Bush was able to take the fact that he was breaking the law and listening in on a few conversations, a few conversations. He was able to take that and spin it around to, oh, we only listen in on terrorists. And, you know, most Americans, I think, kind of bought it. And they're not.
They had a great line, and the Democrats never were able to refute it. And the line was, if Al-Qaeda's talking to someone, we want to know about it. Well,
right.
It's a great line. Of course we do. You can't argue with that.
Right. And so now what it needs to be, what the Democrats need to be saying is, if you're talking to someone, the Republicans want to know about it.
And, of course, they won't come up with anything as good as that. The Senate Judiciary Committee, headed by Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, they intend to hold hearings on this, including calling the head of the phone companies involved. This is AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South, all of whom sold us out. Anybody who has any of those phone companies, they sold you out, folks.
Yeah.
They intend to call the heads of those phone companies, and I was told by Senator Kennedy this morning that if they don't intend to come, they're going to be subpoenaed.
Yeah, and in fact, I have Quest here in Portland, Oregon, and they apparently said, no, we won't give you the records, 3 years ago.
Wow.
And for 3 years, Quest has been refusing to turn over their records, according to this report.
I suspect they're going to see an upswing in business.
Yeah, well, I've already gotten two emails from people saying, you know, if you can change to Quest, do so. Now, you know, I don't think that's any good reason to necessarily change to Quest. It's just another big monopoly phone company. But at least, you know, good on them for, you know, thank God for small favors, I guess. You know, it's a small...
But they've already got you anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, you're already on everything.
They've had me forever.
Yeah.
What can I say? They've had me since the 60s. Oh, my. Now, the other dimension of this thing is that there was yesterday, the big news was that there are two different committees in the Senate that are saying that they want to interrogate Hayden because he's not just a guy who's going to become head of the CIA. He's also a four-star general in the Air Force, and therefore the Armed Services Committee?
Yeah, Armed Services Committee.
Needs to talk to him,
and
that now seems to have slid under the door, or is that going to get some, you know, where's this going to go?
Well, I think that's going to be quite tricky. I don't think the administration would like that to happen. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Republicans on that committee, because all that does is emphasize to the public that, hey, we're putting a general in charge of the CIA.
But wasn't it the Republicans calling for it?
I didn't think it was.
Oh, okay. I don't have the story right in front of me, so I.
Well, you may be right, but it seems to me that that's a massive mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
From a PR viewpoint, I think that's.
I mean, you got Arlen Specter, who's a Republican right now. He's kind of a strange Republican. He's the guy who came up with the single bullet theory way back when, you know, back in '63.
He is. He's somebody who does sometimes think for himself.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not always right, but sometimes, yeah.
He intends to call Hayden back to talk about warrantless wiretapping, and, you know, absolutely intends to get him to talk. I don't know how.
Yeah. Well,
but he intends to try.
All he has to do is call Alberto Gonzalez. He's got some techniques.
Yeah, he has the best technique.
Be the hard to make us speak. Oh,
or
man.
Not.
Yeah, there you go. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, for a change.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. There was a bright light, a shattering of shop windows. The mom in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the love, this is called.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and the organic wine company, Eco Wine, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And Gene in Kenmore, Washington on the line. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi, Tim.
Tom. Close enough.
Good to
what's
talk
up, Gene?
To you again.
Thank
I
you.
Really appreciate your American patriotic songs.
Oh, thank you.
It really boosts my spirit. I was sorry that I didn't have a chance to get on while Lester Brown was speaking with you.
Well, we just scratched the surface of his book. I mean, there's like 10 or 12 chapters in there, and we touched on the topics of two of them. There's never enough time, you know, particularly with a work that's almost 300 pages long.
Well, may I ask you, does he cover or address the issue that the climate scientists are most concerned about? They call
yes.
it the feedback crisis.
Yes. Yeah, the reverse thermostat. Yeah, the fact that we are slipping into positive feedback. For those people who don't know what we're talking about, Gene, normally a thermostat in a home, for example, turns off when the temperature rises to the desirable point.
Correct.
And it turns on when the temperature drops. And that's basically how our biosphere has been operating. It's a self-regulating mechanism. But now, as a result of global warming, we are melting the ice off and thus revealing dark temperature absorbing, sunlight absorbing areas of permafrost, which then in the process of melting release more greenhouse gases, principally methane and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, also water vapor. And that then further warms up the atmosphere, which further accelerates the rate of melting of the ice over the permafrost, which further increases. So it's the equivalent of setting your thermostat so that whenever the temperature in the house reaches a certain point, instead of turning off the furnace, it turns on the furnace.
Right.
And this is called a positive feedback loop instead of a negative feedback loop. And yes, he has a chapter about that in his book. And of course, I do also in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, both essentially about the same thing. Yeah, we just didn't get to it in our conversation.
And all of these systems are multiplying
yes.
The effect, the net effect.
Yes.
I don't know if you folks in Portland have a program on public access. Well, not a program, but one of the programmers is called Pirate TV.
I don't know.
And they broadcast the Meridian Report by a man named David Wasdell, W-A-S-D-E-L-L. He's the director of the Meridian Program.
Mm-hmm.
And they have published this report, which was the result of the studies of these couple of thousand climate scientists, called the Meridian Report, The Feedback Crisis in Climate yeah. Change. And I have an email address for them, www.meridian.org.uk.
Okay, great.
And
it's
a fantastic video.
Great. Well, Gene, thank you very much for the information. I appreciate your calling and sharing that with us. And you're absolutely right. The whole concept of positive feedback is something that, A, most people don't get. They just think global warming is the world is going to get slightly warmer and slightly warmer and slightly warmer, and they don't realize that there's a tipping point. And some are suggesting that we have hit that tipping point, that we're at that tipping point, that we're close to that tipping point, and not good. It's just not good. You're absolutely right. Phil in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good morning, or good afternoon, as the case may be. I feel sometimes that we're almost living in the plot of Catch-22.
Who's Osarian?
Oh, well, America.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Because I got to tell you, that law that they came up with, the judgment that the lawyers who were investigating illegality
right.
don't have a security clearance to investigate secrets that are being, you know, our search for secrets. Anyway, what I wanted to talk about was the impeachment, because
yes, sir.
In the 70s, we got over Agnew being impeached. We got over Nixon being impeached, and the Republican Party began their march to dominance. I mean, they learned those lessons well.
Yes.
And you can see how they don't go under oath right now. And George Bush is vastly underestimated. I swear to you, when he was first elected, I just was living, that was like waking up in Catch-22.
Yeah.
And here he is, and he's a Teflon president. There is no law that will stick to him.
Yeah. And well, we'll see. But I agree with you that those people who think that George W. Bush is just a buffoon or a cartoon character or he's not too bright, they're making a terrible mistake. This guy is cunning like a fox.
Yeah.
And the people around him.
Fox, I think we impeach him. I don't think we wait for 08. I don't trust those elections. I don't trust the 2006 elections.
I agree with you, Phil.
I don't think we mess around.
I agree with you.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call.
Oh, and read Ultimate. I mean, buy Ultimate Sacrifice. I always want to plug your book whenever I can.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, it's going to be on the Discovery Channel tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Time.
I'll check it out. Anyway.
Great. Thanks a lot,
Phil. Have a great weekend. You're welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You too. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
And I loved hearing you yesterday on Sam and Janine's show, and you said something that I had never heard before, and that was about Jimmy Carter. He, I guess he was responsible for raising standards on miles per gallon the car should be getting, and that by, I think you said, 1986, we would have been foreign oil independent. And that's just shocking to me.
Yeah, that was actually Robert Kennedy Jr. called in when I was on the
right,
air, and he laid out the statistics. But the clip that I played was Jimmy Carter. This is Jimmy Carter on July 15th, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one. I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And then here's the real heartbreaker, what he was doing.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Not just 20% of our electricity, 20% of our energy.
Wow.
That's mind-boggling. And he actually set us on the path to do it, and we would be there now if it wasn't for Ronald Reagan coming
to us. I know. It's just horrible. Can I ask you one question? I hope this is quick. What actually caused the energy crisis in the 70s? Was it artificial or...
Well, it was two things. Number one, we were living beyond our means. We had reached the point where... it was getting more and more difficult and expensive to extract oil here in the continental United States, so we started importing a lot of oil. That was through the late 60s and early 70s.
Uh-huh.
And then the mid-70s was really when it started to peak out. And then, you know, there was the war. I think it was the Six-Day War. I can't keep track of the Middle Eastern wars, but
uh-huh.
whichever war it was, the United States took the side of Israel in that, and the Arab countries retaliated, OPEC retaliated by cutting off our oil supply. And I remember Louise and I were living in Detroit at the time. In fact, she was pregnant with our oldest child, so this must have been 33 years ago. The city, I remember people getting shot in gas lines because
you had to
wait 8-10 hours to get a tank of gasoline. I remember the stores, the supermarket stores, by the third day of this thing, because the Teamsters went on strike, as I recall, or at least some of the truckers went on strike. By the third day, you could walk into the supermarkets; they were empty. They were just absolutely empty. I mean, the shelves were stripped of everything except paper plates because people were hoarding because they were anticipating an absolute meltdown disaster. I mean, it was a very, very, very difficult time.
Yeah, I was just a little bit younger than you, but I remember it quite well.
Yeah.
So
in a way, it was a natural phenomenon, Amy,
yes.
in as much as we were already at that point living beyond our means, but in a way it was also artificial because it was a product of that war in the Middle East and the Arab reaction to it. And now we're living way beyond our means. Now instead of importing 5-10% of our oil, we're importing, it's only 40-50% of our oil, and we're very vulnerable. Amy, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks, Tom.
Good
Bye.
To hear from you. I appreciate it. Rebecca in Edmonds, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, we have about a minute left. What's up?
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to talk about and urge people to contact their senators to oppose the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the D.C. Circuit Court.
Right. This guy that Karl Rove wants to have on that court so that he'll get Karl Rove off when Karl gets indicted.
And since the time is limited, I just want to say the quickest way to learn about this and do something is go to People for the American Way, www.pfaw.org.
Right, and also thinkprogress.org has
thinkprogress. I haven't been there, but I watched it on C-SPAN yesterday, and the thing people need to know is he's been Bush's right-hand man, writing signing statements for him, doing all these things. He was Alberto Gonzalez's main deputy on the subject of judicial nominees.
Right, and not
he's
only that,
dangerous guy.
He was also worked for Ken Starr in the prosecution of Bill Clinton and the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Excuse me, and people don't realize how important the D.C. Circuit Court is.
Yes,
the most powerful federal court other than the U.S. Supreme Court.
Because any cases where somebody sues the government end up before that court. People who work in Washington, D.C. who get busted end up before that court. And a lot of people from that court end up on the Supreme Court, a disproportionate
amount. Well, they approved him in the committee this morning, but now it goes to the full Senate. We need to get really busy on this.
Okay, the toll-free number for Congress, you can call your senators. You have two. Each one of us has two. 888-355-3588, unless you live in Washington, D.C., and then you can just pick anybody's senator. 1-888-355-3588, toll free all across the United States to let your senators know, and call both of them. If you know, in the case of you and in Washington, that would be Cantwell and Murray.
Right.
And you know, let them know. Let them know. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Also, if you want to just dial direct, if you have free long distance, for example, and you can call 202. This is the main switchboard into Capitol Hill. 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121. It's 46 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
How do you sleep while the rest of us cry? How do you dream when a mother has no chance to say goodbye? How do you walk with your head held high? Can you even look me? Tell me why.
It's all we want to know, George. It's all we want to know. Why? Well, actually, we think we know. It's all about putting Republicans back into power, wasn't it? This nice little war. And making some bucks for your oil buddies. Yeah, that's a fine plan. 200,000 guns the U.S. sent to Iraqi security forces. Now in the hands of terrorists, apparently. 99-ton cache of AK-47s that was to have been secretly flown out from a U.S. base in Bosnia. 4 plane loads of arms vanished. Vanished. The work was contracted. They subcontracted this thing. They gave it out to private contractors. And the private contractor, gee, what a surprise. The free market works. The private contractor said, hey, who's going to pay the most for this? And apparently al-Zarqawi is willing to pay more. The Moldovan airline used to transport the shipment was blasted by the UN in 2003 for smuggling arms to Liberia. So, but it was the low bidder, so hey, let's use them. And now 200,000 AK-47s in the hands of people shooting at our troops in Iraq. One arms broker's lawyer is said to have admitted that nearly all of a shipment of, this is another one, of a shipment of 1,500 AK-47s went missing. U.S. officials said the $270 million worth of equipment could not be traced. Meanwhile, Aerocom, the Moldovan air firm at the center of the 200,000 missing AK-47s, was stripped of its license by its national authorities a day before the first shipment. Two other companies in the complicated sale claimed to have papers proving the guns were delivered in Iraq but refused to show them. Right. Amnesty International saying, hey, let's do something about this. This is from The Mirror. The Mirror, a UK newspaper. As spokeswoman Kate Allen of Amnesty International said, it's out of control and costing hundreds of thousands of lives every year. The UK has a real chance to do something about it when the UN meets in June. But don't expect the UN to do anything as long as John Bolton is our ambassador to the United Nations and the United States has veto power. Dennis in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great.
I've been thinking about this 700-ton ammonium nitrate bomb that they're attempting to set off in Nevada.
Yeah, they've just delayed it now.
Now, and here's why I think they delayed it. There's concerns about this bomb stirring up, ambient radiation and sending it downrange.
Right, from previous nuclear tests that have left the dirt under the top layer radioactive. Yeah.
Now, here's my thought about this. I believe there's no possible use for a 700-ton bomb because you can't deliver it. What I think might be going to happen is they're going to test a bunker buster. And the radiation from that that's just, the radiation that this bomb kicked up. I don't believe that they're going to set off this bomb. I bet it's going to be a nuclear test that they're trying to sneak in there.
Well, it could be. I frankly doubt that, Dennis, because I think it would be fairly easily detected. My guess is that, and I think, actually, this isn't even a guess, this is what I've read in news reports, is that the reason that they want to set off this bomb is to simulate the effect of a small tactical nuclear weapon. And by doing this with conventional explosives, they can determine how much of a tactical nuke they need, how much of a charge they need in a tactical nuke to go how deep into the earth and melt how much soil in order to create a bomb that can penetrate deep enough to take out, for example, a hidden Iranian nuclear program.
Right. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, and so this is the kind of the real world equivalent of a computer simulation. And they're simulating a nuclear explosion. That's why it takes so much conventional explosive, is because they're simulating basically a small nuclear bomb.
I see. So I guess I've fallen into the conspiracy theory field here.
Well, it could be. I mean, it's conceivable that what you're saying is right, and that the reason that they're putting out this publicity that it's going to stir up radioactive dust, and therefore, hey, when you get a little radiation downwind, don't worry. That's just the dust that was there to conceal an actual nuclear explosion. But my guess is if they wanted to do a nuclear explosion, they'd just do it. I mean, we've walked away from the ABM treaty. There's nothing legally constraining us, as far as I know, right now.
Well, I think wouldn't another nuclear test now that might cause some unfortunate publicity for them, and maybe I just thought they were trying to hide it. How can you tell an approximate size of a blast the difference in the weaponry? You know, is
actually, I think there's sufficiently sophisticated technology out there. A, that it would be possible to detect it, and B, if it was in fact a nuke. This administration, as they are discovering, is not airtight. I mean, you've got the NSA leaks coming out now today, the whole thing about the phone companies and millions of phone records. If it was a nuke, I don't think that they could keep it completely covered up. Although, who knows? There's a lot of things they have kept covered up for a lot of years, Dennis, including there's still a million records hidden about the JFK assassination, which we'll be talking about tonight on the Discovery Channel at 9 o'clock. So, it's conceivable. I wouldn't discount what you're saying as conspiracy theory in a negative context. I mean, clearly it is one, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just, I just don't think that they need to do that. That's my point. I think that they will accomplish their mission with a conventional explosive. It's the Tom Hartman Program. 3 minutes before the hour. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So do we just get rid of the voting machines, or do we start saying, I'm Tom Hartman and I voted for John Kerry, and just say it. Just write it out. Just go in and say, no more secret ballot. Or do we do both? I mean, how do we solve this problem? It was referenced in the first hour of the program. Somebody called in and said, this is all well and good. And Nancy Pelosi is out there saying, hey, we're going to take back the House in 06. But small problem that you'll find Greg Palast pointing out, Mark Crispin Miller pointing out, Bev Harris, over at blackboxvoting.org, votersunite.org, Lynn Landis over at ecotalk.org pointing out some serious problems. What do we do? Lynn Landis is with us. Hey, Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here with us. First of all, just give us an update on the status of the voting machine debacle across the United States.
Well, thanks to the good works of Bev Harris and Harry Hursty, they're confirming now that these Diebold machines do have backdoors purposely put in that allows for the unauthorized downloading of software. And in fact, you know, the problems just continue to mount as ESNS isn't even providing ballots for certain municipalities in Texas and across the country.
ESNS being the company that Chuck Hagel used to be.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because it seems like it's devolving into organized chaos as these elections officials, you know, outsource their, you know, their job responsibilities to a couple, really a handful of corporations that are not getting the job done. You know, of course, you have to question the constitutionality of privatizing an election anyway. But, you know, some activists were encouraged when I think it was something more than perhaps 20 states enacted legislation, passed legislation to require ballot printers on touchscreen machines. But the experience in New Jersey with Sequoia, which is I think about the third largest voting machine company, is that they continue to drag their feet providing these ballot printers. Now they're saying it will cost $2,000 to put the ballot printers in, and what went little noticed when the legislature passed that legislation was that they gave the Attorney General a way out. They gave him the authority to just waive that requirement when 2007 or 8 comes along, and there you have it. Yeah, they had an escape hatch, and there's another company, very very small company called Avante. Mm-hmm. And Avante, they could provide voting machines with ballot printers right now. And Sequoia, as I have been told, wrote letters to all the counties in New Jersey. And the Attorney General, I understand, also did something similar, discouraging these counties from going with Avante. I've also been told that the state of Pennsylvania won't even certify a ballot printer. And so whatever people thought were going to be accomplished by these ballot printers, I don't think it's ever going to happen. So my advice over the past year has been evolving. Initially, I was advising that people hold parallel elections outside their polling places, but, you know, that's a labor-intensive, difficult thing to do. The second thing I thought of that would help to act as a check against this completely insecure way of voting we're engaging in would be for voters to send to their candidates, the candidates they voted for, particularly in important elections, a card or letter after they voted for them on the day of election, have a card or a letter ready, and mail it to the candidate's campaign quarters or headquarters, and let them know you voted for them. Because, interestingly, this has already happened. Last year, there was an election in North Carolina. Many voting machines failed. Many votes were lost, and the Republican candidate gathered 1,400 signatures or affidavits from voters testifying that they voted for him, and on the basis of that, the Democrat conceded because the Republican led by about 2,400 votes, and 1,400 is all he needed to prove he would have won anyway. So that is a terrific example of the need to go public with our votes. And the important thing for people to understand is secrecy came into the voting process well after the Civil War, when blacks were voting in large numbers, and I feel very strongly that it's primary use has been to allow elections officials and others to manipulate election results. And, of course, right now the others are the voting machine companies themselves.
So you would suggest that it was the primarily Democratic South in the late 1800s. I think 1892, Grover Cleveland, the first president elected by secret ballot. And that in the late 1800s, during Reconstruction, that when African Americans were allowed to vote, the votes were simply changed by the white people who controlled the polls and ballots?
Well, three things happened to make voting a secret, remote process after the Civil War. In the 1870s, absentee voting for soldiers was allowed. In the 1880s, the secret ballot was adopted. And in the 1890s, the first voting machines were used. And actually, 1892 was not only the year Grover Cleveland was elected by secret ballot, it was also the year the U.S. Congress allowed voting machines to be used in federal elections. I don't think all this secrecy is to protect the voter. I think it's to manipulate election results. And when you think of it, why would we hold ourselves to a lower standard than we hold those we're electing to office? I mean, after all, when we elect our town councilmen or state legislators or our congresspeople, they all have to vote in public. We demand that they vote in public so that we can see what they've done. And in many cases, they have friends, families, investments, occupations that could be affected by their votes.
But I think that there's a sense in the United States that there's a few things that are still private. You know, our bank balance, our vote, our, you know, the details of our sex lives. I mean, whatever. There's a few things that just, you know, are not to be out there. For example, you have the situation just in the last week where this guy who was giving out contracts on behalf of, as I recall, HUD, said to a contractor who had already gotten a contract, "We're going to take this thing away from you because you just spoke ill of President Bush."
Yeah, but he could have also, I mean, I do think that a lot of those contracts, when they're let out, people's voter registration is looked up as well. And we all, you know, many of us, I would say two-thirds of the electorate registers Democrat or Republican, and I think that is used against us. But you have to balance the not really knowing if your vote was counted properly against whatever protection you think you may be getting.
Why not just do what Canada did? Canada experimented in the election of 2000 with not all of Canada, but parts of Quebec, at least that I know of. We lived in Vermont. It was just north of us. Experimented with voting machines. They didn't like it. It didn't work. People didn't trust it. And so they said, "That's it. We're going back to paper." And they just used paper there.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, but we're not there
at all.
As do
all the European nations, by the way.
Well,
I mean,
right,
you know,
why
don't we just do what the rest of the world does?
Well, you know, I think because my feeling is I question even those results. For instance, in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in other places where they have allowed, they have the hand-counted paper ballots, which I was, and I still do, actively encourage. But they often will take those ballots to a central counting location where they get counted. They're not often counted locally. And in England, they're expanding by leaps and bounds the use of absentee votes. So
well, they're doing vote by mail, actually, in some areas.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, they call it postal voting.
Right.
And
the entire state of Oregon is that way.
Yes, and a lot of Washington's going that way. Oregon is not only postal voting, but I don't think their voters understand that all those ballots are counted by optical scanners, again, controlled by a handful of corporations.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Lynn Landis, her website, ecotalk.org, if you want more information on this. And of course, she's also recommending votersunite.org and blackboxvoting.org. But Lynn's website, ecotalk.org. Lynn, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome, Tom.
Great talking with you. Thought-provoking conversation. There's a lot here, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 16 minutes.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
D-O-D. voting machines make our elections so easy. Devote electronic machines are not for the faint or the queasy. The tabulations in secret are made. If they get a lemon, they make lemonade. The results can be changed if you know the code. The results can be changed and our country explode. And then Devolt will then be running the show, and no one will ever know it's the perfect crime.
And welcome back, my friends. No one will ever know. 22 minutes past the hour. There's a few of us who know. I'm telling you about it. Mark Crispin Miller wrote a great book, Fooled Again, about this stuff, and among others. 22 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Richard in Seattle on the line. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. An honor and a privilege. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Well, thanks for calling.
I wanted to, first of all, agree with you in the sense that I think, as much as I don't trust the electronic voting for, you know, various reasons, I still think that we need to keep the vote private.
Mm-hmm.
Not secret necessarily, but private and confirmed, you know,
yeah,
with paper trail or whatever.
I'm inclined to agree with you. But
because, you mentioned just previously about the contractor who didn't get the contract.
Right.
You know, things like that are going to happen more and more. But I just wanted to share, because I'm sure you remember this. Remember the classic All in the Family with Archie Bunker?
Oh, yeah.
Edith? There was a moment where Archie went out all pompous and self-righteous to vote, and he wasn't registered anymore because he hadn't voted since last presidential election. And he turns to Edith and he goes, Edith, this is how we're going to use our vote. And
right.
She goes into the booth, and then she comes back out, and they're sitting home, and Archie, of course, doesn't admit that he didn't get a vote.
Right.
And he says, well, what if our candidate had lost by just one vote? And Edith chimes up, or two, implying that maybe she didn't vote the way Archie told her.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of what I'm trying to say, is that we need to have that privacy. We need to have that autonomy when you enter the voting booth to be able to speak your mind freely without coercion, without fear of intimidation or retribution.
Yeah, I agree with you, Richard. Richard, thank you very much for the call. You make
Thanks
the point
for your time.
Very
Bye-bye.
Eloquently. Yeah, Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi.
Follow that one, Jeff.
Yeah, well, being on the front lines of voting, the foray into trying to get rid of electronic voting, I understand the privacy concern, but it's kind of bizarre that in our caucuses, we have an open vote.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of situations, we actually do vote openly, then all of a sudden we have the private vote in the final one. And the private vote is actually one of the biggest things that's in the way of us getting a secure system right now, because as soon as we talk about doing most systems, people say, well, how are the handicapped going to use this? Because like a blind person, if it's not a Braille ballot, and if it's a piece of paper, they can't verify who's on the ballot, so they lose their privacy unless we go total electronic and they just verify it by electronic means where it reads back the vote.
Right.
So it's a tough one. It's a catch-22 because it's also the thorn on our side. And I would say, are you willing to sacrifice your privacy? I would be willing to sacrifice my privacy to have the vote counted accurately. I'd love to have privacy. If we can find a way to have both, great, but the most fundamental right, as Thomas Paine would say, is to have the vote counted accurately. And so it's a big dilemma right now, although...
Are you suggesting that it's a big dilemma exclusively because we have the both moral and legal imperative to respect the rights of disabled voters?
No, I'm saying we do need to respect handicapped voters. It's very, very, very important to give everyone the same class of citizenship.
But it seems that there, there historically there have been ways around that that don't require us to simply have to hand our vote over to an electronic machine.
Well, what has happened is actually, no, in a lot of cases there weren't ways around that. People did have to have their ballots read back to them by usually bringing, you know, some assistant in or something like that.
Right, but it would be somebody that they could trust, somebody from one of the blind organizations or a relative or somebody.
But the argument there is they have lost their secure vote, the right to privacy.
Right, but then you're suggesting that everybody should lose the right to privacy because of that.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying these are the arguments, and I don't agree with a lot of them. I mean, it's like, you know, we can't do everything perfectly. We have to have, you know, it's like most of my handicapped friends would be willing to have someone assist them in a lot of cases. Now, there are others that it is absolutely, you know, it's almost like talking about abortion, where if there's any...
Well, the simple solution to this, Jeff, is everybody votes on paper except handicapped folks who can't vote on paper, and we'll get some electronic machines for them that are relatively secure.
Yeah, but then I was in a meeting about that just a few days ago, and I said this, just what you said. They say that creates a different class of citizen. They can track the vote of the handicapped people because they vote, you know, there are very few of them, and they'll be voting in electronic machines. So there's a...
Well, what you do is you make the electronic machines available to anybody who wants to use them.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, they would be at the polling place.
Yeah, I'm just saying, this is a tough controversy we're dealing with. And thanks, Lynn is one of the best in the industry as far as dealing with this.
Yeah, okay.
And by the way, Germany does count their votes twice up front. They figure out where the problems are.
By paper.
Yeah, but they count the paper ballots twice.
Wow. Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. Appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Lamar Waldron's on the line. Lamar and I wrote this book, Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of JFK, which will be profiled tonight on the Discovery Channel at 9 o'clock. Hey, Lamar.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you with us here again. Let's just go over very quickly the basic premise. Well, first of all, you've seen the Discovery Channel piece that's going to show tonight. I have not seen it. What's it all? What can people expect?
Well, it's a good summary of our book. And again, the show's title is Conspiracy Files: JFK Assassination. I know the times are 9 p.m. Eastern and later at 1 a.m. And people can adjust that for their own part of the country there. But it basically covers our book. They have some critics, they have us, they have a lot of other experts, and we basically lay out in the show and show lots of documentation from the National Archives, the story that you and I got from almost two dozen Kennedy associates. And that's that John and Robert Kennedy had a never-before-revealed plan to stage a coup against Castro and invade Cuba on December the 1st, 1963, just 10 days after Dallas, a plan codenamed AM World by the CIA, a plan withheld from the Warren Commission and every later congressional investigating committee, and that plan was infiltrated, despite the Kennedys' best efforts, by three mafia godfathers from the mafia families that controlled Chicago, Tampa, and the whole state of Louisiana and East Texas. And those godfathers then used parts of that top-secret plan that many of your listeners are just hearing about for the first time today. They used parts of that plan to attempt to murder JFK, to end Bobby's intense prosecution of them. And they first tried in Chicago, 3 weeks before Dallas, in Tampa, Florida, just 4 days before Dallas, an attempt completely covered up for 40 years, so there's plenty of evidence from police and Secret Service officials, even newspaper accounts, then finally succeeding in Dallas. But that resulted in all these cover-ups by Bobby Kennedy, Lyndon, J. Edgar Hoover, not to protect the assassins, but to protect this top-secret coup invasion plan whose exposure a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis could have literally triggered World War III, and that's led to even today. There's still a million CIA files alone about the JFK assassination, mostly about this plan and the mafia's infiltration, that are still secret, even though Congress unanimously passed the JFK Act in 1992 to release all those files.
What percentage, Lamar, of the people inside the now LBJ administration, formerly the Kennedy administration, in the weeks immediately after the assassination of John Kennedy, do you think? I've talked to a number of the people in this, you know, that we talked to for in researching this book. You talked to Dean Rusk. I wasn't there when you talked to Dean Rusk, for example. And you've talked to, I know, a number of the Johnson administration folks who I haven't. And I'm just curious. I've never asked you this question before. You know, we've worked on this thing for 17 years. What percentage of the folks inside the LBJ, the brand new LBJ administration as a result of the death of Kennedy, thought that Kennedy had been assassinated by Castro by proxy?
Well, several higher key officials, because you have to remember a couple of things. One is the mafia intentionally laid an awful lot of evidence and used patsies. There was a different patsy for each city, by the way. But used patsies that could be tied back to Castro in somehow. The patsy in Tampa was even a Cuban exile. And so the mafia deliberately laid a lot of information pointing to Castro. And indeed, we have incredible information in the book, and some of it's in the documentary tonight, you know, where it's just easy to see, you know, this associate of the Godfather in Tampa, you know, is writing and telling the FBI about Castro killing Kennedy. But he's also adding, oh, and I know about this secret invasion plot, too. So, of course, the FBI has to treat him with kid gloves and back off. But, you know, Lyndon Johnson did for a time. He later on came to kind of broaden his view. The head of the CIA, John McCone, did for a time. Secretary of the Army, Cyrus Vance, did. Bobby initially realized it was one of the Cuban exiles who had kind of sold out this plan. He even told a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter that a few hours after the assassination. Then all this mafia-backed Castro did it evidence came in, but Bobby was eventually able to sort that out again and told associates later in his life that the mafia godfather of New Orleans had been behind the killing of his brother. So that Castro did it evidence was definitely planted. All of it traces back to people associated with these mafia godfathers. But that was an overriding concern, and that's why LBJ and the Warren Commission and Chief Justice Earl Warren, their main concern, you know, wasn't finding out a conspiracy no matter how broad it is. I mean, imagine if the head of the Supreme Court of the United States, you know, here he is going to Dallas to talk to Jack Ruby. What kind of legal scenario does that create if Ruby's found to be part of the assassination? But, you know, it was to reassure the public and to prevent World War III.
Right, and the World War III would have been started if the American public thought that Castro had killed Jack Kennedy.
Exactly, and or if Lyndon Johnson, who had been left out of the coup plans totally, had been, you know, quickly brought up to speed, and he decided to invade Cuba. Well, if we invade Cuba, you know, Russia was going to retaliate against us. If we had an unprovoked invasion, I want to make really clear, what John and Robert Kennedy had in mind for Cuba was not an Iraq-style preemptive invasion. It was going to be a palace coup by someone close to Castro. Castro's death would be blamed on a Russian or a Russian sympathizer. And the U.S. forces, starting with some Cuban exile troops, multiracial unit, all from Cuba, trained at Fort Benning, would be the first troops in, and they would be invited in by the new leader of the Cuban government to help restore order and prevent a Soviet-style takeover. But an all-out, full-scale, unprovoked invasion on Cuba by the U.S., by Lyndon Johnson, thinking Castro had killed Kennedy, yeah, that could have provoked World War III.
There are still a million documents that this government is concealing. There was a law passed during the Clinton administration that said that the government had to declassify these documents. You are continuing, even to this day, to correspond with, talk with, and bang your head against the wall of the folks in Washington, D.C. who are responsible for these documents. Give our listeners an update on what's happening with that.
Well, I'll give you an even better example. There was a Cuban exile group, the DRE, that had a very widely publicized confrontation with Oswald a couple of months before the assassination. And that's been the subject of a lawsuit by a Washington Post reporter who wants the files about that Cuban exile group. We had a widely publicized contact with Oswald.
A lawsuit filed when?
Actually, just a couple of years ago. Now, get this. In the late 70s, the House Select Committee on Assassination was investigating the assassination. The congressional investigators asked the CIA, well, what about this exile group? You know, was the CIA controlling them? CIA said, oh, no, no, we had nothing to do with that group. And in here, we'll assign a liaison officer from the CIA to work with you to help you find, you know, other stuff. But you don't need to worry about that exile group. So liaison officer, they assigned George Ioannidis, was the CIA controller for that exile group. He was actually getting the reports from the exile group about their contacts with Oswald. I mean, what incredible gall. For the CIA to first deny the contact, then assign the liaison with the CIA who was the contact. And the CIA admits they have at least 1,000 of those documents, and they've told the judge and Morley, who's fighting the lawsuit, no, we're not only not going to give them to you, we're not even going to tell you what they're about.
Why?
Well, they don't have to give a reason. We think it's they're trying to use a national security excuse that ties back into AM World and the secret coup plan. So, again, that's why we want to get this word out. All the documents people will see tonight and that are in our book have been officially declassified. These aren't Dan Rather documents. They're from the National Archives. People can go to our website, ultimatesacrificethebook.com, and see some of them. They can see even more on an independent website, maryferrell.org. And these documents are there, but what has been released hints at so many hundreds of thousands of additional documents. And again, a very respected government watchdog agency, OMB Watch, in Washington, they found, and their report's online, anybody can see it, there were over 1 million CIA files still unreleased. Now, John Kerry introduced recently, he was a big part of getting that 1992 JFK Act passed. He just introduced a Martin Luther King Act to get all the Martin Luther King records declassified. But
Lamar, we have less than a minute left. How is this relevant to today?
Well, if people look at so much in the news today about the national security whistleblowers, intelligence failures, increasing government security, domestic surveillance, a lot of this has its roots in this continuing secrecy going back to the JFK assassination. A whistleblower, Chicago Secret Service agent, who tried to blow the whistle to the Warren Commission on the Chicago and Tampa attempts, was framed by the mafia, arrested, thrown in jail for 6 years, still trying to clear his name. People will see him tonight. So what we'd like people to do is, well, you know, watch the show, go to the website, ultimatesacrificethebook.com, but let your congressperson and senator know that you want those JFK files released, and you want justice for this framed Secret Service agent who was trying to do his job and got sent to prison for 6 years because of it.
But in a very real way, this also set the frame for what the Bush administration is carrying on even to this day, which is we need to keep these things secret for your own good.
Well, and keep in mind, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, when they were in the Ford administration in the mid-70s with Bush Sr., CIA director, they kept this information secret from the American public and from Congress then. So this is not, what they're doing today is not new behavior.
They didn't just hide it from us, they hid it from Congress as well.
That's true.
And Cheney and Rumsfeld.
They're still
amazing.
Doing it today.
45 minutes past the hour, Lamar Waldron, the book Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba and the murder of JFK. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, otherwise known as Little Beirut by Bush Sr. Tom Hartman here with you. The Senate... This from Kent Conrad's website. Thanks to Blue in the chat room for the link. The Senate will convene at 9:30 this morning. That's already happened, and will proceed to consideration of the conference report accompanying H.R. 4297, the Tax Relief Extension Reconciliation Act. That's basically the Senate saying, yeah, if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, we're going to give you maximum income tax of 15%. That's happening there. And then cloture, he says, was filed on the modified substitute amendment to Senate Bill 1955 and the Small Business Health Plans Bill. Notwithstanding Rule 22, there will be 60 minutes debate, equally divided between the chairman and ranking member of the HELP Committee on that. So we'll see how that shakes out. But, again, you might want to let your senators know your thoughts on this. Toll-free United States Senate 1-888-355-3588 And, of course, if you want to call direct, it's 202-225-3121. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Mario in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Mario, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
About electronic voting.
Yes, sir.
Down in Australia, believe it or not, they saw the problems we had in 2000 here in the United States. They decided to go a different route. They have a system called EVAX. It is open source software on an open source system, an operating system, Linux.
Right.
And they use it without a problem. You can go into Google, type in EVACS. It'll bring up the website. The software is there for download and to view. And it explains how the whole system works. They don't have a problem with it. Works very well, according to the ACT site here.
You know, the only problem with that is that no corporation can make a big profit off open source software. You're talking about deprivatizing the voting system. You're talking about taking it away from Diebold and from
the
ESNS.
Well, they give it back to the government.
Yeah, giving it back to the people. I mean, you know, you really think the Republicans are going to allow that to happen?
Oh, I know that. They wouldn't allow that. But, hey, Democrats take back the House and the Senate. There you go.
But how do they do it when the votes are counted on Republican machines?
Well, I don't know how they do it. Yeah. You can do
we
it,
have
though.
To do it. Here's the simple answer, Mario. Overwhelming numbers.
Yeah.
So big that the rig will be obvious. That's the only way that we can do it. I mean, that's as happened in the Ukraine.
I know.
Mario, thanks for the call. Thanks for the tip, by the way. It's fascinating. I'm checking it out right now, and David is on it as well. Bob in Shelton, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up?
I saw this morning on TV the average price of gasoline in the country was $2.80-something. And then immediately the local news, they said, gee, the average price in Washington is $3.11, 20-some cents difference.
Washington State or Washington, D.C.?
Pardon me?
Washington State or Washington, D.C.?
Washington State.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if that reflects the vote by the two senators here on the Anwar deal.
Oh, interesting.
As a little payback by the oil company.
Is the state being punished? Heaven only knows. I mean, I thought it was really strange. In fact, actually, I predicted it. You'll recall last week when the House voted out a bill, in fact, I think it was unanimous, that if price gouging could be demonstrated, that the executives in the oil industry would go to jail. And I said, you know, they're going to find some oil really quick. And sure enough, they did. They went from a projection of 500 million barrels in the, you know, shortage to a 200 million barrel surplus in less than an hour, all of a sudden, the whole oil industry. But it's, you know, not to make a bad pun, but it's a drop in the bucket or in the barrel. We are facing two things. Number one, the meltdown of the dollar. Well, really three things. Number one, the meltdown of the dollar. So of course the price is going to go up. Number two, China and India industrializing very aggressively, far more rapidly and more aggressively than we did in the 19th and early 20th century, or than Europe did in the 18th and 19th centuries, and thus competing with us for oil. And number three, the fact that we're hitting peak oil, that you know, pretty much all the oil that can be found has been found, and it's getting harder and more expensive to get. And then four, you toss into that mix the fact that the oil companies have, basically there's four oil companies left in the United States. They've formed, for all practical purposes, a cartel and are fixing prices. We're going to actually have a guest on, Al Martin, tomorrow talking about that. And what you have is this perfect storm.
Well, so I worked in the oil business, and another thing that I have thought of, back in the mid-80s, we imported gasoline from China, not crude oil, but gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So they have refining capacity there.
Well, we're exporting gasoline right now.
Well, but also, China has the biggest supply of coal in the world. Mm-hmm. Wherever there's coal, there's oil.
Yeah.
Nobody's mentioning that.
Yeah, I suspect that as time goes on and China starts seriously and aggressively prospecting, there may be some surprises coming down the road. But, you know, we'll see how that shakes out. I have to run. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Berkeley in Sacramento, California. Hey, Berkeley, we have just a few seconds left. Quick comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, hey, Tom, I just wanted to point out the continuing hypocrisy here from these right-wingers. That caller about a half hour ago that was, you know, screaming about equal protection under the Constitution for the Diebold voters, you know, the handicapped voters.
Well, Jeff was not, I mean, Jeff's on our side. He was saying that this is the problem. This is the legal and moral problem that we face. I know that Diebold has been given big bucks to some of these disability groups to get them to push for Diebold machines. Is that your point?
In reference to the handicap situation, like, you can't have Diebold machines for handicapped voters, but, because of the separation between... my point was, it's funny how they'll say you can't have two different classes of citizens for, voting machines, but when it comes to, gay marriage, of course, then it's okay to have it.
There you go. Okay, that's a good one. Berkeley, thanks for the comment. I appreciate it. Tomorrow, Al Martin will be here claiming the nationwide average oil refiner's profit margin right now is $22 a barrel. And Bernie Sanders, of course, will be with us tomorrow. Also, tonight I'll be on the Majority Report, filling in for Janine and Sam on Air America Radio. And tonight at 9 o'clock, we'll be on the Discovery Channel. Lamar and I will be on there. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. CAG, you're it. We'll see you again. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.